It was expected that the threat of losing the right to choose abortion would drive women to the polls and carry Kamala Harris to victory over the self-admitted misogynist and sexist Donald Trump. But on Election Day, abortion came in third place. Dr. Brian H. Williams, a Black Harvard-trained trauma surgeon who's worked the inner-city emergency rooms throughout his career, says the women who'll be hurt most by the war on reproductive rights are Black and brown. And there was one issue on the ballot that didn't require voters to check the box, but some analysts believe it was actually the number one issue driving voters to the polls: racism. Good morning, good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, our usual Wednesday host, Denise Young, has had a death in the family and is taking time off to mourn our second Wednesday, and to mourn and to heal and to regroup. So please join me in sending her and her family our condolences and love. The election math isn't quite as bad as we thought, but the coming Trump administration is shaping up to be worse. As blue Western states and cities finish counting votes, it looks like the popular vote landslide projected for Donald Trump last week turned out to be more like a trickle. When all the votes are counted, he will end up with a margin of roughly 2 points over Vice President Kamala Harris. Presidents Lyndon Johnson in 1964 and Richard Nixon in 1972 won more than 60% of the popular vote. Ronald Reagan in 1984 won 58%. Now those were landslides. Don't get me wrong, it was a bad outcome for Democrats. Trump won all seven swing states, netting himself 312 electoral college votes compared to Biden's 306 in 2020 and Kamala's 226 in this election. Democrats lost control of the Senate. The GOP now has 52 seats and will likely wind up with 53 when the race between incumbent Pennsylvania Democrat Bob Casey and Connecticut corporate titan David McCormick is finally called. The provisional ballots are still being counted in those cases. Republicans will probably hold the House by a slim margin. So yes, none of this is good news, but it's not the top to bottom repudiation of Democrats as it first looked like, and the way to respond is not to launch a civil war within the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, that has already begun. Centrists blame the doctrine of woke, with particular ire for trans Americans. Leftists say Democrats abandon the working class. Both positions are wrong. Others point fingers at the Harris campaign and making abortion the centerpiece. NBC News exit polls show that the issues that voters were most concerned about were, one, the state of the state of democracy, although that meant different things depending on which party you were in. The second issue was the economy, and coming in third place, abortion. So joining us in the studio this morning is Katie O'Connor with the National Women's Law Center. She is the senior director of the Federal Abortion Policy. Good morning, Katie, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Verna. Thanks for having me.
A lot of Democrats and progressives were stunned that abortion didn't appear to influence the voting of more women and that it was actually third on the list of issues that drove most voters to the polls. But what was your reaction Tuesday night as you watched the results being tallied?
Yeah, I mean, you know, from my perspective, looking at the results, it's true that Donald Trump won. It's also true that abortion won. You know, in 7 of the 10 states that had abortion directly on the ballot, abortion won. And I should mention that in, you know, the 3 states where abortion didn't win, there were a lot of really anti-democratic efforts to defeat those measures by the state itself. I mean, Florida is the best example of that. Governor Ron DeSantis's administration pulled out every stop to try to beat the ballot initiative that would have restored abortion rights in Florida. And even in spite of all of that effort, 57% of Floridians still voted in favor of abortion rights. So when I look at the results, I see a need to translate what is happening on abortion policy into who's responsible for those policies. But I don't think there's any question that abortion remains popular remains something that people will turn out for and people will vote for.
And yet it didn't help Kamala Harris in the way that it was expected to. Your thoughts about that? Well, you know, I have one thought. Let me ask you, was it a miscalculation? Do you think perhaps to position abortion so prominently in the Harris campaign?
I don't think it was a miscalculation. Again, I think it was a mistranslation between abortion and who's responsible for the policies that are restricting abortion. I don't understand how this is, but somehow the fact that, you know, Donald Trump brags over and over again about being the person who appointed the three Supreme Court justices that voted with a majority to overturn Roe versus Wade, that didn't translate into people who understanding that Donald Trump is a danger to abortion access nationwide. So I think we have to do some of the work of translating. And I mean, unfortunately, I think the next 4 years are going to give us an opportunity to do that.
Well, women voted for Harris over Trump, but in smaller numbers than in the past. Hillary won women by 13 points and Biden by 15. So, you know, I don't know what we can deduce from that. And there were, as you said, 10 abortion amendments on the ballots in states. And it actually gave women, I felt like, the option of voting to protect their right to abortion. And they could also vote for Donald Trump at the same time. So did the abortion movement anticipate that that might happen when you saw those on the ballot?
Yeah, I don't think we were anticipating so many people feeling sort of complacent about abortion because they were voting for these state ballot initiatives and feeling so complacent that they could vote for anti-abortion candidates, especially at the top of the ticket. But again, I also think that, like, Donald Trump did a great job of muddying the waters about what his position on abortion was. I suspect that you and I are, you know, we've seen this person lie over and over again and change positions over and over again to where we can't trust anything he says. But, you know, I do think that there were some voters who were probably placated by, you know, his last minute effort to say he wouldn't sign a national abortion ban, for instance. So I do think some of that like positions shifting probably made a difference too.
So how does abortion rank in terms of older women? Because I'm wondering if maybe that if the electorate is older and maybe that had an impact on it, had it been more younger women amongst the electorate population, might that have made a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. And I think you've looked at more of the numbers than I have. But from what I have read, like, it seems to me that there is, you know, abortion is popular across ages and genders. And so when it comes to women, like, young women were fired up about this issue, but so were older women. I suspect that it may be like somewhere right in the middle of the age range where we sort of lost some momentum, but young women and old women alike seem to be really supportive of abortion access and willing to show up for it.
Well, you know, white women who traditionally vote Republican voted for Trump despite his misogynistic and sexist actions, but Harris did peel off some of them. Trump beat her by 5 percentage points, but he was more appealing to the younger women than he was in his last election. 7 out of 10 abortion ballots passed, as we've said, but what can you tell us about them? Were they in red states, those abortion ballots that passed?
It was a combination. So we had, you know, several red states and unfortunately several red states that, or swing states, I should say, that did go to Trump. So we had ballot initiatives passing in Arizona, Missouri, Nevada. You know, all three of those states passed abortion ballot measures overwhelmingly and also obviously went to Donald Trump. But then we did have some blue states where hopefully the abortion ballot measures brought people out in numbers. And then I would just mention Florida, where, you know, 57% of the people voted for that ballot initiative. So that's a at this point, a pretty deeply red state where still people showed up and showed out for abortion. It just unfortunately wasn't enough given all the factors that were working against them.
Mm-hmm. So Attorney Katie O'Connor, I saw some footage on the news earlier this week where several women, maybe it was about 7 or 10 of them, were standing in line. They were suing states because they were unable to have abortions. Are you familiar with that story?
Not sure of this particular story, but as we've seen over the past 2.5 years, there's just been like a flood of lawsuits challenging different pieces of different abortion bans. Unfortunately, you know, one of the things we've seen a lot is people who are experiencing emergency pregnancy complications and are fearing for their own health and their own lives. And they are going to the courthouse to try desperately to get the health care that they need. But we've seen some other litigation being filed recently. A good example, and perhaps what you're talking about, is Louisiana has tried to limit access to medication abortion by essentially scheduling the medication that's used in medication abortion as sort of a dangerous substance, which it's absolutely not. And just last week or the week before, we did see some healthcare providers challenge that lawsuit. I can say more about that if you're interested. It's an interesting lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. So as an attorney, can you envision a scenario where a woman could sue the state over the abortion issue?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen that in a number of states. And this is something that was happening even long before Roe versus Wade was overturned. You know, states, especially in the last 15 years or so, that this all really started in 2010 when states just started passing stricter and stricter regulations of abortion. So we didn't see like outright bans on abortion until a few years ago, but we did see laws that were meant to prevent people from getting abortions. There were no other explanations for these laws. And so there has been sort of a steady stream of lawsuits over the past 15 or so years challenging these regulations. All of that has obviously changed in the past 2.5 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, but we are seeing like a renewed importance of state constitutions and state constitutional provisions that might protect abortion access in states more than the federal constitution protects abortion access. And so, we're seeing a lot of people challenge state abortion restrictions and state abortion bans in a number of different ways.
So, I mean, how would that look? How would that, you know, you go to the court and you say, I am suing because I wanted to have an abortion, but the state wouldn't allow me to. And those would be grounds for suing?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we're seeing in a lot of states right now is, you know, states with like outright bans on abortion almost always have some sorts of exceptions. So you can't get there's no abortion in Texas, for instance, but there is an exception if you need an abortion because you have, you know, because there is a threat to your health or your life. And so we are seeing pregnant people go to court and say, look, my life is threatened. My health is threatened because of this pregnancy. I need clarity. My doctor is afraid to provide abortion for me, even though that's the care that I need, because of this law that exposes my doctor to, you know, criminal sanction. And so we're seeing people going to courts, especially saying doctors need more clarity about what these exceptions mean. So a doctor shouldn't have to choose between like providing the healthcare that they know their patient needs and exposing themselves to years in prison and significant financial
fine. So I know a couple of years ago, physicians and some nurse practitioners were being forced to relocate to blue states in order to continue to practice medicine in the manner that they had chosen and not face incarceration or prison time for performing that procedure. Is that still happening? Is there still, you know, sort of a wave of medical professionals moving, relocating for that purpose?
Yes, absolutely. I think Idaho is a great example of this. Idaho is now experiencing like a serious deficit of OBGYNs and is experiencing sort of a maternal health crisis as a result of that. And that's because abortion is part of healthcare. It is part of the healthcare that obstetricians and gynecologists have to provide to pregnant people. And when it is criminalized, when a doctor faces potential time in prison for doing the work that is part of their jobs, it becomes untenable for them to stay in that state. And so we're seeing it certainly in Idaho, but I suspect we're going to see it other places. You know, what we have seen over the past 2.5 years is we now have abortion deserts across huge swaths of the country. And, you know, if you look at the Midwest and the Southeast, there are huge areas where you can't get abortion access. And those are likely to become areas where you can't get the maternal medicine that you need either.
So yeah, that was my question. What does the legal landscape look like for a woman choosing abortion in 2024? How many states still ban abortions outright? Are you saying the majority?
There are 13 states that have bans on abortion at any phase in pregnancy. And then there are 7 or 8 other states that have bans on abortion at certain stages of pregnancy. I will mention there are at least a few states that have bans on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And it's worth noting that a lot of women, perhaps most women, don't even know that they're pregnant at that point. So that is all but equivalent to a total ban on abortion. So if you look at, you know, these maps where abortion is banned or severely limited, it means that some people are having to cross like multiple state lines to get the care they need.
So there's some pretty extreme laws in the books. I recall a story where a young woman had a miscarriage in her home and she was being charged and I believe facing jail time. And the state officials actually came to her home and examined her toilet in an attempt to make their case against her. Are you familiar with that story?
Yeah, I mean, so this is like a different front on that we're seeing. Like, obviously we're seeing abortion bans and people being unable to get the care that they need, but we're also seeing efforts to criminalize people for their pregnancy outcomes. This is something that's been going on for a while, but it has ratcheted up pretty significantly in the past 2.5 years since Roe versus Wade was overturned. There's an organization called Pregnancy Justice who's been like, they have been documenting these cases of pregnant people being subject to the criminal justice system. And that report shows just a huge spike in criminalization over the past 2.5 years. And that tends to fall into a number of categories, but a lot of it is criminalizing people for substance use while they're pregnant, and criminalizing people for their pregnancy outcomes. And I think it's absolutely no surprise that the people who are most often criminalized for the pregnancy outcomes are the people who are more subject to the criminal justice system generally. So it's Black and Brown people, it's people with low incomes. It is just, you know, pregnancy criminalization is just exacerbating like the disparities in the criminal justice system that we already saw.
At this point in time, has anybody been sentenced to prison or jail time for performing an abortion or for having one?
To my knowledge, no. But there are certainly people in several states who have been, you know, on the precipice of being criminalized for abortion outcomes. We haven't seen, at least as far as I know, any providers being threatened with prosecution yet, but that's in large part because they are too scared to provide the abortions in the first place. And that's how these laws were always supposed to work. It was never meant to like send providers of abortion care to prison. It was about making sure that they don't provide the care in the first place. And so, yeah.
So, there's a pretty dramatic ad out, attorney Katie McConnor, O'Connor, that shows a man and a woman in an intimate relationship, and it's pretty steamy. And they look up, and there's a Republican lawmaker standing in their bedroom, and he snatches the prophylactics away from the man, saying they are illegal. Is there any truth to that? Are there states where using a prophylactic is illegal?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, so the it was Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's the case that the Supreme Court used to overturn Roe versus Wade. And while the majority in that opinion said this is just about abortion, Clarence Thomas in his concurrence said actually it's not just about abortion. Like the foundation for the right to abortion lies on, the jurisprudence that guarantees a right to contraception, that guarantees a right to marital privacy. And so, as much as the Supreme Court might not want to admit it, like all of those things are now up for debate, given that Roe versus Wade has been overturned. And there are states that are already trying to limit access to contraception in some ways. It'll be what we've seen with abortion, which is just a chipping away. But there are long-term or long-acting kinds of contraception like IUDs that are already being restricted by the states. So it is not hyperbolic at all to say, the people who oppose abortion and try to pass abortion bans are also opposed to contraception, and that is certainly on the chopping block.
Wow. So President-elect Donald Trump has said he will not sign a federal abortion ban, that it should be left up to the states to decide. But he has not said whether he would veto such a bill if it came to his death. As an attorney, Katie O'Connor, who's closely monitoring the legal landscape in America around the issue of abortion? What's your biggest concern now that Donald Trump has been reelected? We're not headed back to the days of coat hangers and back alleys, are we?
We're not, although we're not heading back to the days of coat hangers and back alley abortions. What makes this moment different than the days before Roe versus Wade in 1973 is the presence of medication abortion. So medication abortion is very effective, very safe, and right now very available. It is used in nearly two-thirds of the abortions in this country. So I think what concerns me most about the second Trump administration is the possibility that the federal government will try to limit the medication that's used in medication abortion, which could have like serious downstream effects, both in states that ban abortions and in those that don't.
So tell us exactly what is this medication abortion? Is that something that the woman takes on her own?
Yes.
Or is it go ahead, tell us what
Yeah.
exactly is it?
So, medication abortion has been around for about 24 years now. During COVID, it became available by telemedicine, which has made it much more accessible to people who are far from, brick and mortar abortion clinics. And it is now something that people are able to get through telemedicine, and so that makes it much more available. And then I will mention that there are also organizations that provide the medication from overseas pharmacists and stuff like that. So it is much more available than procedural abortions ever were, and it's certainly much more available to people who live in states that are hostile to abortion rights. So any effort to limit abortion medication would really devastate the landscape of abortion access in this country.
Well, so what is your greatest fear as we go into the second term with Trump? Because the Republicans have control of the House. Well, we don't know about the House yet, but the Senate. And if they were to draft a bill, a national bill, a federal bill that would ban abortion, and Trump has not said he would veto it, but what, is there a strategy afoot among pro abortion rights advocates, activists that will combat that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just point back to the election results of this year, of 2022, of 2023. Abortion is popular. It has always been popular. Like since 1973, since we've been polling, poll after poll after poll after poll shows us that, people support abortion access by a consistent and commanding majority. And I think there would be absolute outrage if this Congress and this incoming administration tried to pass an abortion ban. So it's going to be our job to make sure that people understand if that's in the works. And I also think, again, as much as it's hard to trust Donald Trump and his word because his word changes so often, he said he wasn't going to try to restrict abortion at the federal level. And so it is our job as advocates to hold him to that word. So I'm very concerned about the potential for a federal abortion ban, but I think there would be significant political opposition and significant political backlash if that attempt were made. What I'm a little bit more concerned about is that the administration itself could try to limit access to medication abortion. And that would be something that could potentially fly a little bit more under the radar, could go without Congress's, without Congress's participation, and would still have like a really devastating effect. So it's going to be our job to watch and make sure that if any of these attempts sort of any of these attempts sort of surface, that we spark the outrage that we know there would be among the American public, including those people who voted for Donald Trump.
Attorney Katie O'Connor, Senior Director of the Federal Abortion Policy with the National Women's Law Center. Katie, thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you, Verna.
Up next, as a graduate of the Air Force Academy, he was trained to shoot to kill. Decades later, as a Harvard, trained trauma surgeon, Dr. Brian Williams saw firsthand the horrific damage a AK-47 could actually do, and his work now is implementing common sense gun policies across America. We'll be back in a moment.
Hello, this is your WPFW social justice calendar for the week of November 11th. Thursday, online at 6 p.m., local educators will lead Teaching Truths. Educators speak on justice and liberation in the classroom. Monday, November 13th, join us for the Hypothermia Outreach Team Training from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. in the HFSC Social Room at Georgetown University. Tuesday, November 14th, there's a policy discussion on strategies to end homelessness and hunger from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. in the Arupe Multipurpose Room at Georgetown University. Thursday, November 14th, Busboys and Poets on 14th and V hosts When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer at 6 p.m. And on Sunday, November 17th, the Social Justice Convention's Oral History Project happens from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Inspired Teaching Demonstration PCS, 200 Douglas Street Northeast, Washington, D.C. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Whether it's a rally, workshop, forum, or community gathering, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event at least 2 weeks in advance. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order received. The Social Justice Calendar is one more way WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm still Verna Avery Brown. Brian H. Williams wasn't always the polished, handsome, Harvard-trained trauma surgeon saving countless lives of inner-city youth. His career started out caressing an M16 rifle and learning how to shoot to kill. Williams was a cadet in the Air Force Academy. Since then, he has served as a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellow at the National Academy of Medicine, professor of trauma and acute surgery at the University of Chicago School of Medicine, author of the acclaimed book, The Bodies Keep Coming, and former candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Good morning, Dr. Williams, and welcome back to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Verna. Good to be back again. Thank you for having me.
Yes. First, let me offer my condolences for the death of your cousin. Is there an investigation underway as to who shot him?
Mentioning that. And as many of these inner city shootings occur, they go unsolved. And it's been over a year and a half now, and we still don't know who my cousin's killer is. But I shared that story to let people know that when I talk about gun violence prevention, it's not just a professional endeavor for me as a trauma surgeon, it's also personal. That being a survivor, mm-hmm. I know what it's like to not have closure when you lose someone to this violence. And that's what drives me to do what I can to make this country safer from preventable gun violence deaths.
What exactly happened in that case, briefly?
He was in his front yard, and I don't know all the details, but he's in his front yard when someone shot and killed him. The details of what happened before are still fuzzy. But we had his ceremony. Sorry, just a little bit emotional. It was on Easter weekend, about a year and a half ago. So mm-hmm. when many people were celebrating Easter, our family was burying my cousin.
Okay. Sounds like you guys might have been really close. And again, my condolences. So now, Dr. Williams, in an article you wrote, you describe yourself as a, quote, Black trauma surgeon. Ending gun violence demands fighting for racial justice. So how are gun violence and racial justice connected, in your opinion?
They are absolutely inseparable. And until we have an honest reckoning about that, we will still be in this never-ending cycle of what it means to own guns in this country. And why do I say that? I always try to connect my experience as a trauma surgeon with the data to back it up and how policy can make a difference. So in my experience serving as a trauma surgeon in big cities, the overwhelming majority of my victims have been young Black men. Think about the data. Within 24 hours of this interview, over half of the homicide deaths due to firearms will be young Black men, right? Let's talk about gun violence deaths. We now know that guns are the number one cause of death for all American children and teens. That happened in about 2021. But for the decade prior to that, it was the number one cause of death for Black children and teens. But that get the same sort of attention that it's getting now. So it matters the narratives that we talk about. We need to elevate all the narratives in this debate, but also talk about how it influences the policies that we pass, like stand your ground laws, and how do we support community violence intervention programs and the criminal justice system. That is all intertwined with racial injustice. So we need to address that in order to make a big dent in addressing gun violence.
And so how would you describe your relationship with guns, Dr. Williams? Because, you know, as I said in the early introduction, you know, you started out with the Air Force Academy. How would you describe that? That's sort of a unique relationship, don't you think?
Right. So at the Air Force Academy, all of us go through firearms training. We all go through some sort of flight training. So that was part of our training to become an Air Force officer. And at that time, I did not intend to become a doctor. I could not foresee that years later, I would actually be a trauma surgeon taking care of gun violence victims. And now, having been on the front lines of this epidemic for so long, I see that this is just destroying lives and families and communities, and that there are things that we can do about that to keep ourselves safe that have nothing to do with guns, right? They have nothing to do with guns. I'll look back to your last segment with Ms. O'Connor, which was fantastic. You know, when we talk about abortion access, that's also about comprehensive health care for women. So when you're denying that, you're denying health care for women, which is antithetical to what we as doctors, we take an oath to heal. We talk about gun violence prevention. You can save lives and not talk about guns. Okay. We can do something about ensuring that everyone has access to quality education, stable housing, good jobs. These are all things that contribute to endemic violence in communities. Mental health services, not one by themselves, but together we can make a difference. So let's talk about guns, but also talk about the other societal issues that contribute to endemic violence that we can address as a country.
Well, most doctors would just, you know, put their head down, keep their scalpel handy, and not address those issues. But you have chosen not to pursue that path. Was there something in your upbringing, do you think, that has influenced you in this way?
Well, that's interesting. I didn't think about that, but you know, my mother and my father was kind of a stoic, quiet person. He's also an Air Force veteran. My mother didn't take any mess from anybody. Like, she's about standing up for justice. So I'm sure that's probably within me also. Just grew up in this family where we were committed to service and what we can do to make the world a better place. These are values that were important to me growing up. They're important to my family. And I internalized those even more as an Air Force officer. And when I went out into the world, my whole mindset was, how do I use my experience, my skills, my expertise to just help people? That's why I transitioned from being an engineer in the Air Force, which is my first career, to going into medicine and seeing how I can help people. So this is part of the ongoing journey of what can I do to make the world a better place?
And I read where your mother wouldn't even allow you to have toy guns in the house.
Well, she knew, right? This is back in the 70s. She knew that a young Black kid with a gun was a target. We saw this with Tamir Rice, right? In the 2012, I think that's when it happened. He was playing with a toy gun in the Cleveland Park. Police officer showed up, saw him with a gun, shot and killed him. So she knew that there was a danger there, and she wanted to protect me from that. I didn't understand that until many, many years later, obviously. But there, we have to Black men are considered a threat in many scenarios, and even Black boys are considered a threat. So I just want to, we need to talk about our history, be able to share our own stories in a way to try to make the country better, make the country safer, try to keep working towards unity. That is kind of a perennial job for us, but we don't give up, right? And this election is a perfect example. Let's get past the doom and gloom, buckle down and get back to work to making sure that America lives up to the ideals that it professes.
So I want to sort of skip back to, in your work as a trauma surgeon, did you witness or perform any abortions? You know, you write that Black and Hispanic women will be the biggest victims in the battle to eradicate women's reproductive rights.
So I'm a trauma and acute care surgeon. So I have two board certifications in surgery and critical care. But part of being an acute care surgeon is that you are in the hospital for all sorts of emergencies. And one of those emergencies that come across our way sometimes is women that are having an ectopic pregnancy.
Which is a pregnancy in the fallopian tubes.
Exactly. And that is a pregnancy that will be treated with mifepristone, the medication they are trying to ban to prevent abortions, right? So when I talk about comprehensive medical care, that is a prime example of that. So in those situations where a woman is coming in with, a ruptured ectopic, they're bleeding to death, there are times that people like me have to work together with our OB colleagues to save that woman's life. But I want to touch upon what you said next, which is how this is an issue of racial equity, right? We already know that Black and Hispanic women, even the best circumstances, are suffering greater maternal mortality rates due to systemic bias within the healthcare system. When you put up more barriers to care, as we expect this administration to do, those disparities will worsen. So everyone suffers. We try to limit healthcare to those that are most vulnerable.
So, Dr. Williams, you were running for office in Congress, and I would imagine you've been monitoring the election quite closely. Republicans have sort of a holy alliance with their guns. What kind of legislation are you hoping to get passed to make this country safer, to bring down that statistic that gun violence is the number one death of Black children in this country?
Well, it's really unfortunate that the election turned out the way it did, because we can expect that there will be significant resistance to any further progression in saving lives due to gun violence. I served as a health policy advisor to Senator Chris Murphy, who led the charge to get passed to pass the Bipartisan Safe Communities Act, which was the most significant gun safety bill in the generation. And that had expanded background checks, money for community violence intervention programs, mental health funding, closing the boyfriend loophole. Those are some things, but we need to continue to go further, right? There's more we need to do. Continue to invest in communities, because communities that are closer to the problem often have the solution, the best solutions. To ban assault weapons. People that aren't trained on these weapons do not need that. They don't need to be in our city streets. They just don't belong there. Raise the minimum age to purchase a weapon. 21 should be the minimum age, most people say. Like right now, and why is that important, Vern? Let me tell you why that matters. Because between the ages of 18 and 21, that age group is committing suicide by firearms at 40% higher rate than they were a decade ago.
Suicide
by firearms at a rate 40% higher than they were a decade ago. They also commit homicides at 3 times the rate of people 21 and over. So just raising the age to 21 will save a lot of lives from those two things. Now, many will say it should be more than that, 25 maybe, but like, mm-hmm. Let's take what we can get, right? Let's take what we can get in 21. So raise the age, minimum age to purchase a weapon should be a goal. However, what can we expect in this administration? They're already talking about passing constitutional concealed reciprocity. And what that means, no matter what state you live in, if you have a concealed carry permit, you can carry a concealed weapon in any state in the country. That will just flood the streets with more untrained people with weapons. And I will tell you, as a doctor, I don't have that option. I have to get a license in every single state that I want to train or that I want to practice. So if you're going to make more guns available, they're certainly going to have more doctors to take care of the victims that are going to result from these injuries.
Mm-hmm. So I asked you earlier if you're familiar with Project 2025. You want to share your response?
Yeah,
it sort of gives you heartache in the morning.
Yes, yes. I'm familiar with Project 2025, and it really codifies some of the most draconian policies that we certainly, I feel, do not represent what is the best of America, right? We're living in an age where this election, hate and intolerance triumphed over humanity, right? And I've served, my father has served, we've served back to the Civil War, right? Even when they didn't want us in this country, we still believed that we could do the work to ensure that America lives up to the ideals which it professes in the Constitution. And this election should be a wake-up call that the work never ends. Do not get complacent. We still have to keep pushing forward to ensure that every living person in this country has an opportunity to achieve the best versions of themselves.
So are you familiar with the Project 2016 that was in place when Trump was first elected to office? And how does it compare to Project 2025?
Did they actually have a plan in 2016? That just looked to me like they just came in and just delivered one. Was there an actual plan? I didn't know about this, Verna. I was not aware of that.
Apparently it's every 4 years, the Heritage Foundation puts it out. So is there anything in particular in Project 2025 that you are really bracing yourself for that you think would have a dramatic effect on people?
One, the expansion of a guns everywhere mentality in the society. I don't think that's good for us on many levels. Two, this focus on taking away access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. That I feel will have a devastating effect. You know, we live in the wealthiest country on the planet. We spend the most on healthcare compared to any other high wealth country, and we still have the worst outcomes, right? If you take away healthcare, that is only going to get worse. You can make make the humanity argument why we should take care of our citizens. There's also a very good economic argument to be made. So mm-hmm. why would we want to take away healthcare from those in need? I just can't support. And also, just continuing with the last discussion, the continued attack and hostility towards comprehensive healthcare for women. Those are probably the top three things that concern me.
Now, Dr. Brian H. Williams, do you think you'll take another stab or shot at becoming a congressperson?
My campaign ended March, and I've had a lot of time since then. Well, between the elections, to think about what's going to happen next. I've always worked to try to bridge my experience as a veteran and as a doctor with the data and how policy can be a force for good for so many people, right? It is an amplifier, magnifier that trumps many other things. We do need more people with critical thinking skills in Congress. We need more people that are committed to public service and not just pursuing power in Congress. And I do feel I check off all those boxes. So short answer to will I run again? I don't know. I know there are many ways that I can serve that don't require me to be in elected office. However, I recognize that there is great opportunity for significant impact were I to run it again.
Mm-hmm. Now, so do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with us? Anything that I have not asked you about directly that you feel you want to include in this discussion? Parting words.
We still can make a difference. I think, like many people, last week I was numb for a few days, but you know, I wake up inspired knowing that we've been here before, and especially Black folks are resilient, right? Mm-hmm. We know that the work does not stop because it feels as if everything is stacked against us. We need to do the work, not just for us, not just for the present, but we need to do what we can to ensure future generations have a chance to experience all the opportunities that this country has provided my family, but can provide for so much more. So, let's get off this interview. I'm getting back to work, Verna. I am getting back to work. And I plan to join many people that are others that are motivated to do the same.
Now, you know, the one thing I think I read in your work where you said that race, and I'm wondering if you mean racism, can actually impact a person's health directly. Racism. Can a few words on that in a minute or two?
Yeah, discuss this in the book. We talk a lot in medicine, or actually when I was training, that race is a risk factor. Race is a risk factor for diabetes, for hypertension, for a heart disease, you know, so many things. Race is a risk factor for gun violence. And I said, it's not race, it's racism. Mm-hmm. And beyond this interpersonal racism, it's the systemic racism that exists that we need to address. If, just for example, we talk about redlining and how Black neighborhoods were redlined generations ago. The federal government drew red lines on the loan owners' maps and said, do not invest in these areas. It's a bad investment. Just happened to be where all the Black folks lived. When you divest like that, you lose quality homes, education, businesses, access to healthcare, and it keeps on going. Oh, so yes, sure. Racism is risk factor for bad health.
Dr. Brian H. Williams, Harvard-trained trauma surgeon, a cadet in the Air Force Academy at one time. He has served as a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellow at the National Academy of Medicine, professor of trauma and acute surgery at the University of Chicago School of Medicine, and author of the acclaimed book, The Bodies Keep Coming, and former candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Thank you for being our guest again this morning, Dr. Williams.
Thank you very much for having me, Brenda. It's a pleasure.
Well, Latino men made the most dramatic shift in the 2024 election, leaning heavily to the right. When Hillary ran in 2016, she captured 31% of the Latino men vote, but that number dropped to 23% when Biden ran. And last week, Trump won this group handily. Some analysts have pointed to the weak economy, while others credit Trump's strong man macho persona. But TikTok poster Nathaniel Something, who is himself Mexican-American, offers this explanation for his brother's political leanings.
This video is to my fellow Mexicans. If you're not Mexican, stick around, you might learn something. This isn't to Latinos, because that is an over-homogenizing term. I'm not speaking to communities that I'm not that familiar with. Cubanos, Puerto Ricanos, Colombianos, y todo. This is to my fellow Mexicans. I know why you voted the way you did. Sure, machismo might have played into it, the economy, but this is about the anti-blackness that runs rampant in Mexican communities, despite the ever-presence of Afro-Latinos in Mexico. This anti-blackness is something we picked up from our oppressors, which is what I want to talk about today. We have a lot more in common with black people than you might fucking imagine. We too were victims of European colonization. Spaniards came over here and they oppressed us, they enslaved us, they f***ed us. They stripped us of our culture, our religion, our languages. Who does that sound like to you? What do you think the encomiendo system was? What do you think encomenderos were? Those were slave owners. It was a slave system. We were property. The only difference is that the Spanish crown got to decide how we were inherited, traded, relocated. That's it. We were still property to be passed around and abused. We were property. Who does that sound like to you? The Bracero program, funneling Mexicans into America so that they could work for slave wages in fields. And here we are, what, 60 years later, and they're still working in fields for slave wages. Who does that sound like to you? Segregation in the South, whites only, schools, bathrooms, restaurants, toilets, water fountains, that applied to us. We weren't welcome in those spaces. Why do you think Dolores Huerta, Cesar Chavez, why do you think these people brought up the plight of black people when they discussed our liberation? Because intersectionality matters, because somos mismo, because we are not better than anybody. There's no one community that we get to hold ourselves higher than.
Nathaniel Something on TikTok. Overall, Trump garnered 45% of the Latino vote. And Nathaniel's not the only political observer who reached that conclusion. MSNBC host Joy Reid also has connections in the immigrant community, and her suspicions mirror his.
This is Joy Reid in her struggle session to try to explain why he got 45% of Latinos on Tuesday night.
Coming from an immigrant family, there is this sort of trying to be super American.
Totally.
When people come here, because I know some African immigrants who are all the way Trump. And it's this idea of I want to be with the side that's waving the biggest flag. I want to fit in. And there is a huge element, to be honest, of anti-blackness in a lot of this. And there's this idea that I'm black, but I'm not black. I may look black to you. I may be black if I'm walking through Bloomingdale's and get followed around. But in my mind, I'm identifying with whiteness because whiteness means privilege and it means not being a black American. This has to be unpacked because this shift among Latino men is significant, and it says something about where we're going in this country.
Latinos are anti-black. They want to be white. That's why they voted for Trump.
Host Joy Reid, there was no box on the ballot that said I'm voting my racist fears, but some political analysts brave enough to call it out Note that the fear of the country being taken over by Black and brown people drove whites to the polls in droves. Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. I want to thank our guests, Attorney Katie O'Connor and Dr. Brian Williams. And thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. Thank you, our engineer extraordinaire, Michael Nasella. Up next, wake up and stay woke. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.